Right, the regular and supplemental meetings are called to order. The supplemental meeting will be recessed for a moment of silence. Right. First item is approval of minutes from the meeting of June 11th. Everybody wants to look over their minutes, and there's no questions. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes?
Moved.
Get a second.
Second.
Motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. Do we have any public comments? You can signify by raising your hand online. All right.
John, do you guys have any public comment?
Nobody to raise hand.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Moving
Zach,
right along.
are there any trustees on the line?
Yvette.
Yes.
That's okay, great.
And Rob may officially agree. I'm moving along. Let's see, regarding items for consideration, the police officer trustee election results.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. First of all, I would like to say thank you for tolerating our air conditioning situation this morning. If the noise is too loud for you, let us know. I think we have two going now.
Yes.
But we can turn those off. Or if you want more noise and more cooling, let us know. We can turn two more off. I don't know if I'm going to be able to stand the noise at this level, but just let us know. So.
The noise isn't too bad, but if everybody could speak up a little.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blow all the way around on this side of the table.
Okay. What did you say, Kelly?
I heard it, but I'm listening really hard.
Okay. All right. So we'll go on. If you can't hear me, let me know. So the first item that we have is a certification of the police officer trustee election. As you know, there was only one candidate, Matt, for the firefighter election. So we had the police election. It was conducted by an outside firm, Yes Elections. The voting period ended on June 30th, and Michael Tagliente received the majority of the vote. So he will be continuing with us until August 31st, 2029. So congratulations to you.
Did Matt proclaim himself president for life?
No, what happened?
No, sir. No, sir.
The report from the election company is attached here, and you can see that the turnout is low, which is pretty typical. Only active members can vote in the election. The turnout rate was 7.36%. Are there any questions about the election? Okay. Could I get a motion to certify the election results of the police officer trustee?
I'll move.
Second.
Thank you.
All in favor of certifying the results, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. Like bigger, I'm untouchable now.
Okay, the next item we have is the selection of the actuary. We've talked about this a couple of times with the board, and the board asked that staff manage the process. So Josh and I, we issued an RFP, and we, the two of us and the former executive director of the Austin Police Retirement Fund, reviewed the proposals and conducted interviews of the firms. We brought her in to help us just to have a third set of eyes on it, and she's very experienced, so we thought that was helpful. It turned out to be very helpful. So we did receive five proposals, including Siegel, and we went through the process, and we're here today to recommend to you that we retain Milliman as an actuary for a five-year contract. We feel like the five-year contract, actually, the timing is perfect because they'll get in place, they'll have a couple of years under their belt, and then some important dates in the funding policy kick in, which are the experience study, the new gain loss layer, and migrating to the full ADC. So the timing of, if we're going to switch actuaries, this is a very good time to do it. And we felt Milliman was very strong. Well, actually, all of the firms were very strong, and I appreciate all of them going through the process with us. You could tell that they spent a lot of time on the proposals, which was, you know, very appreciative. But Milliman stood out to us because of the strength and the reputation of Milliman. They're a global firm. They are nationally recognized as a top-tier actuarial firm. They've been performing actuarial services for 75 years. They have over 300 public pension plan clients, including six of the seven largest in the country. They also proposed what we determined to be the strongest team for us. So they proposed a co-lead team structure, which would be the two leads would be Matt Larrabee and Ryan Falls. Ryan will be the primary contact person, and he is located. He lives in Texas, and he works out of their Dallas office, so that would be nice to have kind of a Dallas location. Matt Larrabee will be on the account. He's the kind of the technical lead for the account. He is widely known and respected in actuarial services circles. He's got more than 30 years experience, including he's the lead actuary for the Texas County and District Retirement System. And he really likes working on like these unique systems like ours, problems. He seems like a real problem solver.
Does he have any magic math that can help?
He's got a lot of charts, I can tell you.
What I would imagine ours would be a challenge for him.
Yeah.
In the actuarial world, it would be like a...
Well, know, and we asked him, like, why are you interested in us? We're smaller than a lot of your clients. And he said, I just like these kinds of challenges that are, you know, not your regular everyday situation. So he really likes that. He is also... He helped design the curriculum and is an instructor for the Public Pension Trustee Institute course sponsored by the IFEPB organization. He's written the most recent or co-wrote the most recent actuarial funding policies and practice white paper for the actuarial consulting actuaries. So he's very well respected. And he has committed that he's just not a name in a proposal and he will be showing. So that's good. Ryan has 25 years experience, and he has experience working with corridor structures. He's worked on the Austin Employees Plan and the Austin Police Plan. He's also worked on Fort Worth when they did their changes. Ryan has been with Milliman for 3 years. Prior to that, he was with GRS for a decade, and before that, he was with Buck. And he was with Buck when they were our actuary. He worked on this account. And we talked to him about that. And his role when he was here was he was doing technical work at the direction of the lead actuary. He wasn't in a decision-making role. And Josh had talked to me about Ryan over the years and always had a lot of respect for him. He did do some presentations, but we never felt like he was involved with any of the issues that we had with Buck. So in talking to him and talking to other people that have worked with Ryan and with Josh, I feel very comfortable that he would be a great lead for us. And he remembers, he's got a great memory. He remembered a strange provision in our plan that really isn't even in the plan documents, that it's this Arnett provision. He remembered that, which I thought was impressive. Besides the two leads, their team that's beneath them, the analysts and the technical team, was by far the strongest. They also had a very good peer review structure. So we felt like, you know, the most important thing with the actuary is their team, and the team was excellent. Felt very good about that. They also have strong funding policy and risk modeling expertise. There wasn't a big difference in fees between all the firms, probably because they asked questions on what are the firms you're currently, the fees you're currently paying. So they were all right in line with each other. The Siegel contract goes to the end of the year, and because we'll still need to talk to Siegel when we have actuarial questions that come up on member situations, which happens sometimes. If we sign a contract with Milliman, their first step is to set our system up in their software. And then they replicate the 1/1/26 valuation to make sure that they're in line with where Siegel was and they are understanding all the provisions in the plan. That takes about 12 weeks, which puts them in line to really hit the ground running in January with the 1/1/27 valuation. So the timing of this is working out as we had hoped. Milliman has replicated Siegel's work 4 times in the last 5 years, so they know how they do things and they don't anticipate any issues with that. That was a lot. Are there any questions? Or
I have a question. Has there been a past practice or a policy to when an actuary is up for review, has there been a past practice change, or how do you go into it looking at keeping Siegel or not? How does that work?
Well, the board hasn't had made a motion. It's not official policy, but the board made a motion, and we followed this since 2016, that every 5 years we will do a request for proposal for the main professional services, which include the actuary, the auditor, the legislative consultants, somebody else. Investment consultant. Every 5 years, unless the board explicitly says we don't need to do it. And we have gone back to the board a couple of times and said, you know, Siegel was with us during 17. It's important to keep him through this 2024 process. And the board said, okay, don't do the RFP. So we have to do a solicitation unless you all tell us not to. We don't have to change. There's nothing that says we have to change. And we went in this picking the best firm. We didn't have a preconceived idea that we were going to switch and we were not going to switch.
So it was just an ordinary RFP process.
Yep. Okay. Just ordinary.
And so how long is the engagement for?
5 years.
In line with.
Yep. Any other questions? No? Okay. Could I get a motion to approve the... I don't know, Nim, if you want to pull up the motion or if this one's... Actually, this motion is probably fine.
That's fine.
This motion that's on the screen will be fine if somebody wants to make that.
So approve the TEF's recommended actuarial firm and authorize the executive director to enter into an agreement subject to purview to review by legal counsel with the actuarial firm. So move.
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
Kelly, can you have Milliman come in after they've had a chance to sit with Siegel? I'd like them to sit down and explain any actuarial differences they noted. Just kind of, I think it'd be a good level set for us to kind of see what happened between two guys looking at the same set of data.
Okay, sure.
What can three autonomous agree on?
Okay, the next item is future board agenda planning. I'm still trying to get a meeting that is, you know, shorter than these, which are still pretty short from where we used to be. Haven't been very successful yet. I was looking at Ryan, but he's out of the room. So in the August meeting, the big items that we anticipate having are mid-year budget review and the asset allocation and potentially a private equity investment. It will also be Brenda's last meeting in the August meeting. And we'll do, you know, because she wants to do it one last time, she'll also, in addition to the budget review, do the quarterly financial report. So that's what we anticipate. September, we're hoping.
Did you arrange this, Brenda? You warned us about the HVAC system. So you warned us in the wintertime and the thing goes down, you're leaving. And just don't say I told you so, okay?
No, I mean, you just have to accept you're in Texas in the summer. The AC is going to be a problem at some point.
Well, we will obviously miss you, as you know. And yes, you did warn us about this situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
September right now looks like it will be a pretty short meeting. We have compensation study. I did have board committee appointments on here. I don't know if we need to do that since the trustees aren't training or trading, but that'll be up to TAG and also asset allocation. And right now, October looks pretty small. But let me know if there's anything else you want to add to any of these meetings. But that's what we know so far. As far as the ministerial actions go this month in July, the two things to note are the bottom two items listed here. Annually, we do earnings tests for our disabilities. We have 10 members that are subject to annual earnings tests. We've completed that process. None of them have a reduction, so they didn't make more money outside that we're cause us to reduce our disability payment. And then we did pay the stipend B payments to 4,937 folks got that stipend B payment. That's all on that item. Trustee education and travel classes are listed here. I did want to note that Yvette is also going to attend the Texas Summer Education Forum and represent DPFP down there, but she's not using our budget dollars, so she doesn't need approval here. But you will see her down there.
Yep.
Anybody else want to add their name to any of these classes? Nope. Okay. All right, moving on. The next item I have is just a discussion about the City of Dallas pension obligation bond discussions that they've been having. I wanted to bring this to you because you might have seen in the press that they're talking about issuing pension obligation bonds. And I know some of our members have heard that, and they're wondering, like, well, what does that mean for us? And they're kind of excited about it. And I just wanted to high level explain how this would impact the pension, so you can decide if you want to be for or against it, or what the city's thinking. From what I understand from the public presentations I've seen and my conversations with the CFO. So basically, the city has had conversations both at the committee level. They had a joint committee meeting between their finance committee and their pension committee, and they talked about the possibility of issuing pension obligation bonds. They did that. That committee then referred it to the full council. The council had a conversation about that. They have not set a question yet for the ballot. If they do, they'll have to do that at the August 14th council meeting. The conversation has been to get authorization to issue up to $500 million worth of pension obligation bonds. They would not be issued until the interest rates decline to an acceptable level. Pension obligation bonds have to be issued as taxable debt. So, you know, that's even going to take longer for those rates to get lower. Originally, the city had talked about issuing $500 million in 2028 or 20, I guess it was 2029. When they took it to the city council, they have now split that into $167 million for starting in 2029 for a 3-year period. So it's up to them what structure, when to issue the debt, if to issue the debt, and what the structure of the debt will be. But that's just what they're modeling at this point. The POBs are issued by the city. We have really nothing to do with it other than we have to sign an agreement that says we'll take the money and invest it. That's the only role of our board. We'll receive the proceeds and we'll get to invest the proceeds.
Is a public pension, are there limitations or like legality around the assets that we can reinvest that issuance into, or like
how? No, and that's the reason that it kind of works, and that's the reason they're taxable, is we can invest it just like we would any other money that we have. And it's the reason that the city can't issue POBs and keep the money and invest it themselves, because they don't have the authority to.
So is it a general obligation of the pension plan?
No, the general obligation of the city.
It's just a way for the city to buy down the future obligation.
Yeah.
But so, the reality is why they haven't talked to Ryan to know what the actual return assumption is and if he can hold it, because effectively you're back leveraging the portfolio.
Yeah, correct.
They have been comparing the rates with, you know, our assumed rate of return of 6.5%. So they've said, I mean, in their last presentation, they said the debt would be issued at 6.16 and our assumed rate of return is 6.5. So it clearly makes no sense to do.
And that's not the all in cost. That's the coupon, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's really up to the city. So there's different ways to structure it. And I would kind of worked in that field before I was, at one point in my career, and I've seen people structure it where issue the pension obligation bonds, the city continues to make the same contribution payment, and it's just a way to get funded faster. That's not what the city wants to do. The city wants to reduce.
Okay, what does the city want to do?
So the city wants to they would issue the pension obligation bonds, and then the goal would be to reduce the amount of general fund money, so they would reduce the contributions coming out of the general fund
for us
to take into consideration that we won't be harmed in any way
for them.
It's just the way they're financing what they have to pay.
It gives us
they're moving the money to the debt service. Yes, or money up front.
It's not a project.
If they're paying $240 million out of the general fund,
Hey, I'm sorry. This is Robert. Somebody's talking in the background. I can't hear the conversation. There are two different conversations going on. Sorry about that.
Sorry, Rob. I think that was me.
Okay, thanks.
And this is a concern. If, instead of paying $240 million, $241, they would pay, $77 out of the general fund and then $167 out of these bonds. So instead of giving us $500 million extra to invest, they're just basically kicking the can further down the road in debt, and the taxpayers get to pay the extra, whatever the rate is, 5.5%, 6.16 right now, which they won't issue. What I mean, even if they approved it, they wouldn't issue it for years because the rate's so high right now. So, but it's a way to basically lower their obligation on the general fund that they're paying right now today.
Right. So for the city, they're still going to be paying the same amount, but the pot comes out of the what comes out of the general fund is less because more is going to come out of the debt service fund. And that's clearly, and that they haven't shied away from it. That is their goal, is to shift some of the cost to the debt service fund. For us, we're going to get the same amount of money. We're just going to get some of it sooner, which helps our funding percentage, which our funding level is low. So I'm all in favor of that. I think that's a great thing. In the, I asked the cities to have their actuary send me their numbers, their analysis, and what their actuary is saying, of course, we haven't verified this, is that our funding rate would go from 36.6% to 44.8%. So it's not like we're going to be 70% funded. We're going to be 8% more funded than we were, but because we're such a low funding level, I think that that's a great thing. We're not going to get to 100% funded any sooner. We're not going to get to 70% funding much sooner. They think we might a couple years sooner, but I think that's a rounding issue. So I think there's no downside for us, only an upside. So I think there's no reason we wouldn't be in favor of it, but we'll.
Well, the risk actually is on the city.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Risk is on the city. The decisions are on the city.
Yeah.
Totally
for answer
obligation. Yes. Right.
Yeah. Well, what's the maturity?
They're talking about 20 years
Okay.
because they typically do 20-year debt.
But what did they do with the, I mean, again, I don't know how these typically work. We never really discussed this. So when they issue it, they do they issue it all as a chunk? And what do they do with the remainder as they're paying? I mean, like, is it where does it sit? Like, what do they do with that money?
So they can issue it in any way they want. Sometimes they'll issue in, like they were talking about, let's issue in tranches, because the problem with pension obligation bonds is it's really easy, just like in the stock market. You don't know when the best time is. So if you issue it at the wrong time, like let's say right before a dip, now I've issued $500 million of debt, I've given it to the pension fund, and now we have a 2008 and I've lost all that money.
Right.
If you issue it, when you're on the, bottom of a an upward swing, you're great. So timing is everything in issuing pension obligation bonds. So part of the rationale of phasing it over 3 years is kind of like, trying to work with that timing. The unknown of the timing issue is one of the things they're saying. Plus, the other thing is they have to deal with their overall debt capacity issues.
Has anyone actually spoken to the city from our side about this, or how have those conversations been?
So we were actually really in pushing a POB in 2016, but the city did not want to do that then. They had other priorities for their debt capacity at the time, and they didn't like POBs. The people at the city are different now, and I have talked to Jack Ireland about it. And for our perspective, there's no reason. There's no downside for us. We don't have any risk. The risk is all on the city. I mean, if let's say we get the proceeds in and then there's a crash, what's going to happen is the city's ADC is going to go up and they're just going to be paying more. And they expected to be paying less because it's money paid in. So.
I would say Rob and I served on a committee that studied all these issues and gave a very strong recommendation to the mayor and the city council. Now kind of coming around. This was a while back. Rob can give more color on that.
Oh, yeah. I remember
But
that
is it
special committee.
bizarre that the risk ultimately falls on the city, but then they hand over the money for us to invest it?
Right.
No.
Right.
It's kind of weird, right?
Well, but if you look at
Well,
the
but
overall.
that yeah, that's the whole point. I mean, the entire pension is structured that way.
Right.
Yep.
Oh, that's
Yeah,
fair.
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Exactly. That's why back on our committee, we were pushing for this. I mean, it was this and city assets.
Are you like this over asset sales? Or the committee
We,
did?
I think we even.
No. No, we like the asset sales first and foremost. And PLBs was a little bit, we're kind of nonplussed by it. I mean, it just depends on all the considerations that Kelly identified. At the time, it was actually more attractive because interest rates were lower. So,
Fed funds was zero.
Yeah, it was zero. Right. It was zero for a while.
Now, if you look at the second derivative in the overall structure of the settlement, pension obligation bonds, return profile, it's an interesting moment in time. A very interesting moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the city knows. I mean, the city knows it's not a great time to do POBs. I think they'll do what Kelly said. They'll take a chunk of it. They'll draw down as certain market permits. But I think they're overall confronted with, they're looking at $50 billion deficit now. They're closing the parks and all that, and they're just not prepared to do more of that. They'd rather do it this way. And I understand. I mean, we all understand the competing considerations.
Right, and the city can get this authorization from the voters, and it doesn't expire. It used to expire, but according to the presentation I saw, it no longer expires. I mean, they could hold that authorization, for 3 years, 5 years, 15 years until the interest rate environment's right, and then issue it. It's really their call.
But I thought there was another issue of like the city's rating and how much debt they put on. Is that still that conversation still there? Or like, I mean, I remember they had almost a limitation of how much debt they could also assume. I mean, so what are those conversations?
They're still double A, right? Double
Yeah.
A and double A minus.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the city is saying on that is, well, we're going to do these FHLBs, which necessarily means we're going to do less borrowing on other things in the future because it's all sort of a seamless web of borrowing capacity.
I think the city has, from my understanding, from what I've seen in the conversations, is they've got a debt capacity level that they feel comfortable with. Whether that's a legal debt capacity, I don't know. But they've got a level that they feel comfortable with. And as debt matures and falls off, they issue additional debt. That's just been their, kind of rolling practice, which is pretty common for cities. And that's where they came up with, we think by this time we can take $500 million for the pension, and it fits in with their overall debt
This
plan.
time being what?
What they had modeled was 2029.
Okay.
You can kind of see here where the orange bars are what their contributions would have been out of the general fund, and this would be what their contributions are would be with the debt now out of the general fund. But we're not short any money because it's still gonna we're gonna get the contributions in, and then the actuarial account calculate the ADC, and they'll pay the ADC. Had we not got the 500 million or whatever that amount is, the ADC would be higher. So we're made even.
And the city may have some
Yeah,
different
and
lever that they can pull with respect
there
to the POB.
are actually detractors. I mean, there are people who are saying the city for housing and for parks and other things, but I mean, the city, by all indications that I've received at least, is very resolute about this, and they're going to press on, and they're not going to be swayed.
Yvette, did you have a question? I see your hand is up.
Yes. So actually, Houston Fire did the same thing a couple years ago. They issued a pension obligation bond in regards to the pay parity increase they had with the police. And it actually went really well for them. They structured it, in a way to it to go really fast within the bond market. It sold. So in situations, like this with the city, it doesn't obviously hurt us. It's more on their side. It's just about the timing again, like we've been talking about, of when they actually do issue it. And right now, that's something I follow on the municipal bond side, is it actually is a good time, in regards to the deal getting done. Interest rates are still high, but the levels of interest right now can definitely get the deal done in seconds. I mean, right now, I think it's like the issuance in the muni market for the past 2, 3 years has been higher, and it's also deals are just like literally they're having to lower the yields on deals in order for people to come in and buy them, because or raise the lower the yields on deals, and people are still like oversubscribing. And so I'm curious to see when they actually do issue. I mean, I would hope they would be within the next year or within maybe the next 6 months or so, depending. But That's in my perspective, that what I've seen.
Just add one other perspective. And ERS looked at POVs in the past, and this was under Perry and Fisher. And at that time, we decided not to go with it. But I was surprised how much flexibility there can be. I mean, there's 50-year and there's 100-year POVs, which can adjust the rates. But it's also whether or not it's taxable or not taxable kind of thing. But it is a good alternative, and it does give us more flexibility. So yeah, I think it's a good thing, depending on how they come down.
You just never know. You don't have a crystal ball. You don't know what the markets are going to do. I mean, I think ERF, they did their POB right before the market crashed in 2018. I mean, 2008. So it's just, I mean, why? You just never know. You just never know. And they got hurt hard because of that. They lost probably 30% of the funding that they got from that, or something like that. At least I read. But to your point, so years ago, the board talked about pension obligation bonds, and I did a few different presentations to this board on that, and I did an analysis of the ERF POBs,
Maybe that's better.
and I looked at, were they better off or worse off from doing this? And because of the timing, which was the worst timing they could have had when they issued theirs, they were kind of underwater for a long time. But at the time I did that presentation, which I think was around 2018, they had finally crossed over. And since then, it's, so now it's a major net positive for
I
them.
mean,
But it's really not our issue. And
it absolutely is.
the underlying like credit support is the general obligation taxing authority of the city. And you've got the long run horizon. Who cares what
Right, I agree.
happens?
I agree. I agree. I'm just saying, it just, you just don't never know. Why not,
Are you a citizen of Dallas?
I am.
That's why you care.
That's
why you care.
My only concern, I guess, is that
But that was it.
the members think that we're going to get this POB and they're going to get a COLA right
Right.
away. They're not really going to do that. So we're going to make sure we need to communicate that. But I'll keep monitoring this and let you know how it evolves. Any other questions?
That should be a simple messaging. I mean, it's still 44 versus 70. I mean, it's a statute.
Hey, Ryan. Run, Ryan, run. Run.
Okay. Right.
All right.
That. Oh, my clicker's not working. Can you fix it, or I'll give it to Ryan Brooke.
All right.
No, we can
Figure it
blame.
out.
Just blame Ryan.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Morning. We'll start with the portfolio update. So year to date, through June, we estimate the total overall portfolio is up 6.1% and the public portion up 8.4%. And that's 89% of the assets now in the public portion of the book. Just a few brief updates on investment activity. Year to date, we've received $133 million in private market distributions, the bulk of that coming from the HuffEnergy sale. On the new investment in Francisco Partners, we wrapped up legal diligence and have subscribed to that fund. Continuing to work on the asset allocation study, we'll talk about that here in a minute. And then continuing diligence on new private equity and credit opportunities. I'll come back to this timeline to talk in more detail when we get to the asset allocation item, but I'll hand it over to Divyesh to walk through the rest of the portfolio update.
Thank you, Ryan. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Year to date, MSCI EM index has outperformed and held up quite well in the second quarter against EQI, S&P 500, and UFI index, something that we have been flagging for a while. The key reasoning behind this is, Korean stocks are up 100%, and its weight in MSCI EM has almost doubled as a result of that. And for the first time in 19 years, South Korea and Taiwan has a higher weight in EM index than China.
Really?
And that's been on the back of very few number of stocks. TSMC, one of the semiconductor stocks, is almost 15% of the entire MSCI EM index, a trend that we have been seeing in some of the other indices as well, wherein the market rally is driven by a few number of stocks. As a result of this, we can see a similar story over 3 years. Interesting thing is EM was trailing until December of 2025, but because of the year-to-date performance, EM over a 3-year period is now outperforming the and leading the pack against S&P 500, MSCI Equi IMI, and UFI. We get exposure to EM through our RBC emerging markets, which is up 23.5% for 23.5% year to date and 43.5% for 1 year, outperforming the benchmark.
Which one is that?
The last one, RBC emerging markets. And as a reminder, team at DPFP redeemed $15 million end of May, taking some money off the table from RBC emerging markets. In general, DPFP's public equity portfolio has had a strong performance in June, with all active managers outperforming the benchmark. The public equity portfolio outperformed 1.3% against MSCI Equi World IMI Index, and for year-to-date, it underperformed by 0.4%. Most notable performance here has been from WCM Global Equity, outperforming growth index by almost 6% for the month of June. And as a result of that, I would also like to highlight that we hired them in December 2023. And as a result of recent outperformance, the year-to-date and one-year numbers are coming out much stronger and now outperforming the benchmark. Also, since inception, they have outperformed the benchmark by 6% per annum.
So Boston, go back, Boston Partners?
Boston Partners?
For the 1 year?
Their 1 year has underperformed the benchmark by 50 basis points. And the key reasoning around that has been, I mean, their relative performance has been strong. It's just the dispersion between the rally in some of the selective names and their underweight to USA has led to that underperformance. But we think when the market rotates, they should be able to outperform.
Okay.
And they're our deeper value manager. So typically we, you know, when we get to the Makita report, we compare them against both the core benchmark and the value. And they typically kind of long-term shake out between those two, depending on kind of what's leading the market. Brian, why haven't we fired Manulife or Walter Scott? Got one on deck coming up. Manulife, we've been talking about them for a while. There's some key person risk, smaller team. So we have a recommendation later today to move assets out of that account. Walter Scott, we've been monitoring closely. They are a very quality-focused manager, and that's been out of favor for the last few years. They've made some bad kind of stock selections as well. But we still have confidence that they'll protect us in a down market. And then if one quality comes back in favor, they should perform well.
Narrow portfolio construction, and they didn't have a lot of AI.
Yeah, and they're very underweight the AI
thing. Yeah.
Their growth, yeah.
They've always been.
Yeah. And if you... This is the longest period of underperformance for them since inception. They're underperforming by 60 bips back to 09. That number since inception had been positive until the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a big topic of conversation on the team on kind of how much.
How long can you wait for them to be right?
But I would say if there's a down market they don't protect or we see quality coming back in favor and they're still lagging, that makes it more imminent. But we like kind of the changes we're proposing in the active book, and then we'll continue to evaluate.
Team's still the same there?
Yes, they had one recent departure of a senior PM, but it's a very team-based approach, so that didn't cause too much concern.
Thank you.
And that individual is just retiring. He's not moving to another shop. He's retiring to do more philanthropy and all of those activities, which that individual was always involved in.
So I guess he didn't have his money in the fund.
Sorry.
On fixed income and cash, they've had a fixed income and cash asset class also had a strong month and year-to-date returns driven by Longfellow, outperforming Bloomberg U.S. aggregate index by 30 basis points over the month and also year-to-date. And similar story with private credit asset class as well. The performance there has been driven by MetLife emerging market debt, which is outperforming its benchmark by 270 basis points year to date and 240 basis points annually since inception, which was October of 2022. Also, as you all may remember, most recent addition to this asset class has been ICG Global Total Credit. It has generated strong performance as well out of the gate, with the strategy having a 2.2% performance since inception against a benchmark of 0.5%. Year to date, DPFP has seen net benefit outflows of $33 million and investment gains of $137 million, bringing its preliminary NAV end of June to $2.35 billion, up from $2.25 billion from the start of the year. In terms of liquidity profile, DPFP's projected net monthly outflows are expected to be $4.5 million, and the plan is currently sitting on cash and short-term core bonds worth $303 million against the target of $211 million, enough to cover net outflows until 2031. In terms of asset allocation...
And Ryan, your thinking is you're holding on to cash while we've finalized portfolio allocation and then...
Yeah, we're going through the asset allocation study now. We'll have some... Next item, we'll talk about the tweaks where we think we're going. We're going to bring that back to the IAC in 2 weeks. It's a combination of, I expect the public equity target to come down. So we don't want to redeploy right into equities right now, given current valuation levels plus pending allocation changes.
In terms of asset allocation, we are underweight our public equity targets along with PE and private credit, and overweight on public credit and fixed income. As Ryan mentioned, he'll very shortly cover that and way forward from here in a moment as part of asset allocation.
And one thing I want to cover on this slide, just a nuance with our asset allocation. We have one in our asset allocation, we have one target to public equity that's 58%. All the kind of weights to the individual managers, including, you know, Walter Scott, WCM, and how much DEM, that comes through a structure review we do on the equity portfolio to say, here's how we're going to sub allocate that. Same dynamic in public credit. What we're talking about doing as part of the asset allocation is kind of doing the same thing for fixed income and cash and then defensive to make that one line item as opposed to three discrete allocations that add up to that to give us a bit more flexibility and sub-allocate that with some pending changes on a, you know, as needed or annual basis with that sub allocation there as well.
What do you run?
All right. So I'll start by talking about the asset allocation timeline to date. We kicked off the discussions with the IAC in January, and then we took a bit of a pause to go through the risk and investment belief survey that we did. We incorporated some of that feedback into some initial mixes we brought back to the IAC in April. And then we also did an education piece on risk mitigating strategies at that time. In 2 weeks at the IAC meeting, based on feedback from those few meetings, we plan to bring a few different mixes back for consideration. And then based on IAC feedback, we expect to bring a final recommendation to the board in August.
Ryan, can you? I never really fully understood the objective of the study with the IAC. So are you starting from the IPS? Are you doing the study separate from the IPS? I mean, how do you have this allocation already, which I personally think is overallocated public equities. So how do you start the study?
So we start the study. Typically, we do it every 3 years. This is on a 2 year cycle, given the funding changes and kind of building out the private markets program. So we started with discussions with Makita and getting their updated capital market assumptions across all the asset classes. And then we looked at kind of staff, where would we like to see some changes that we have in terms of asset class targets. And then we layered in, the survey we did was kind of risk profile of the plan and then kind of approval governance process on both public and private markets. So it was kind of twofold in those objectives. There, the first half of it was allocation questions. What level of private markets exposure are you comfortable with? Are you comfortable adding infrastructure or risk mitigating strategies?
I understood that part, yeah, which I thought was good.
Yeah.
But if you just were sober about it and said, set aside what the board's comfort level is, as a fiduciary, what should the optimal compensation be as a fiduciary? I'm just trying to figure out where you start as a level setting.
Yeah, so I would say we start with our current targets, look at, you know, in discussion with the key to what asset classes do we find attractive, what kind of are their long-term expectations, how has our liquidity profile changed, and where would we want to see moves and changes to that allocation? And we wouldn't have done it a year early if we didn't think there are some changes needed to what we have right now.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Thank you. So key changes, we're going to bring three mixes back to the ISE. All three of them have these key changes in them. Public equity target is 58% right now. The peer average is 46%. So it's been very beneficial to the portfolio to have a lot of money in public equities the last 3 and 5 years, but we are overexposed. Private equity, we have a target allocation of 6, only 2% in the ground right now, but we think it's prudent to bring that up marginally. The mixes we're looking at have target allocations to private equity from 8 to 12%. Then in fixed income, we have 13%. We've been kind of thinking about things in that portfolio in the safety reserve concept the last 7 years. And when you look at where we're positioned compared to peers and where I think we should be, we're actually a little bit underweight to fixed income. And I'll talk about the defensive part in a minute. And then the other key change we're talking about is right now we have a natural resources allocation of 3%. That's really just timber and ag. We want to expand that out, relabel it infrastructure, raise that target, with the concept being the key component of that would be infrastructure assets, but allowing kind of flexibility across other real assets categories, mining, minerals, timber, ag, wherever kind of us in Allborn see as attractive areas to go.
One thing, and refresh my memory, who's our real estate advisor?
Allborn. And we haven't been active with them with real estate. We've been over allocated. We still have the portfolios with AEW and Clarion. So we haven't allocated any new money to real estate in over 10 years.
And I understand why. You know, I touched the stove and the stove was hot. But the one thing that I would ask you to consider is talk to Clarion or talk to Townsend or talk to someone who's a real estate pension fund expert and ask them what they see in the market. And just anecdotally, episodically, Ryan, we've had four instances in the last 6 months where people have essentially given us the keys to assets, thrown their hands up in the air and said, help us. And so in one instance, we had someone give us keys and give us money to try and solve a problem for them. And so we're seeing a lot of distress and dislocation in that space. And so we may decide it's not a good time for a tilt. Or if you look at the overall structure of everything, the settlement, pension obligation bonds, you know, there may be a chance to outrun the assumptions with some areas where you have deep distress and you've got some duration now to play with. So, you know, again, my experience is like this and yours is like this, but it may be worth taking a deeper dive with some industry experts to see if it's worth, you know, tilting a little more specifically in real estate rather than infrastructure and commodities.
But if we have, excess cash or rebalancing and we've got a perpetual time horizon, those are usually good times to add to those assets.
Right? It is. So, I mean, we're seeing stuff where, you know, the price point's $150,000 a door and we've got a chance to pick it up at 80. We're about to potentially have somebody essentially ask us what we like because it's a no bid situation where, you know, there's nobody else showing up. And so those are usually really good times to take a hard look. But I mean, you've got the universe to look at, Ryan. It's just, again, anecdotally, it may be worth taking a deeper dive on real estate.
We need to think about how do we want to construct that portfolio once we sell these assets, how much in core. It's all going to be kind of through funds, but we need to start kind of talking to Allborn and our managers about opportunities, you know, once these these assets sell to redeploy, or if, you know, something opportunistic comes up.
Because the other problem is some of the names have problems. And so the people you'd normally go to are people that are trying to keep from drowning themselves. So it's a tough moment in time, but potentially a profitable one.
Yeah. Well, the definition of real estate is really changing as well, as we all know, the complexion. And in the past, everybody had to, you know, follow the gospel of the NCREIF index. And now they're looking at senior living. Now they're looking at, of course, data centers, which is overdone politically in a variety of other ways, but industrial. But, you know, the opportunities are different than they were just 5-6 years ago, and which would be good to look at if we go forward. And both real estate and infrastructure would roll up to the higher real assets category. So we'll have targets to them, but we want to be able to kind of lean into whatever side of that real assets that we find attractive as we actually deploy assets back into the real assets. Okay, I'm talking a minute about risk mitigating strategies and what we've done there and what I know, Tommy. So we, in April, we did an education piece led by Makita on the broader risk mitigating strategies bucket and what that involves and what the purpose of that in the portfolio would be. There's many underlying strategies in that category, including tail risk hedging, long volatility, trend following, some macro type hedge funds. The idea is to get something in the portfolio that's either very defensive if there's an equity market drawdown, or uncorrelated to rates or GDP. So uncorrelated return streams or something that's a bit defensive. I think we have further education required, probably narrowing in on what areas and what types of strategies specifically we think would be beneficial. Like I said, it was a broader based education, so I want to get more targeted there. And we've been thinking about how do we proceed on the asset allocation when it's still an unknown if we'll add any RMS to the portfolio. So what we've considered is relabeling fixed income into fixed income and defensive allocation. And then if we come up with a strategy that we like in that RMS defensive category, we add it down the road into that fixed income defensive asset class through the asset class structure. So this allows us to continue, finish up the asset allocation and maintain flexibility to consider strategies in that defensive bucket. So this chart shows our current allocation, current targets, and what we've labeled the baseline mix. We showed this to the IAC in May. We got two variations on either side of the risk profile from this to consider. We'll come back with, you know, potentially some tweaks to this or one of the other two mixes to discuss in August. Any other questions, feedback on direction?
Are you really thinking about doing fixed income and defensive assets? Defensive assets is kind of interesting label.
Yeah, I mean, I think the function of the fixed income portfolio is somewhat defensive and somewhat, you know, a little bit of yield. We don't have anything that's defensive in the portfolio now, and that's where I think we're exposed, especially with, you know, even if we bring our public equity from 58 down to 52, we're going to need to hold, we're going to need to be overweight pretty much all of our public assets until we go from 11% to and a higher amount in private markets, which is going to take some time. And I think that's why we feel that something in the defensive category would be beneficial to the portfolio in an equity drawdown and could offer either an uncorrelated return stream or, you know, kind of those are the two areas that would be beneficial in our view. The other way we could do it is just add kind of an RMS line item with a zero target. And then if we decide to add something, come back and modify the asset allocation to add a target to that.
Hey, Ryan, as a thought exercise, when you come in and you're finished, can you do two things? One, show us what we look like relative to the peer group that we think is appropriate for us to take a look at. So this is what everybody else that looks like us is doing as you define the universe. And then the other is, I think we have some unique circumstances and some unique opportunities. And so I would challenge you and the team to think about what we can do because only we can do it, because of our size, because of our relationships, You know, it's, you know, objectively a relatively small pension fund in the universe of them. And so things like venture, things like hedge funds, you know, we don't play dice with people's pensions, but, you know, some option overlays might make sense. There's some things that we can do that just simply won't move the needle on even a $20 billion fund. But given the size of our fund, there's some things that, you know, you might want to at least entertain.
Yeah, I agree. And I think kind of the expertise of the board of the IC and kind of willingness to consider some strategies that I think with Aerospeed that we're about to talk about, where we're diverging from only doing long only the equity book to an extension strategy that can add more alpha. That's an example of something that, you know, is a bit more esoteric than what we have in the portfolio now. I think in the private markets, our check size is 15 to 18 million. That gives us ability to move the needle a bit more in some of these smaller funds and be more focused and kind of high conviction in what we do, as opposed to a bigger plan that has to write 20 checks a year.
Yeah, I love KKR, but $15 million, they won't even thank you.
There's no alpha there.
They won't even thank you.
To David's point, there, and I don't want to create more work for you, but there might be some value in picking every other month with IAC and introducing a new differentiated non-mainstream strategy for education and to just kick around and just a thought.
Yeah, that's good. Asymmetric type, you know, phenomenon. So
his other leg's working. You can kick with both feet, man. Kick around more stuff.
Again, but I also encourage you to just don't do the traditional labeling, because as we're doing this education process, this risk management strategy has option overlay and what we talked about. And those two things, when you say it to me again, it's like tail risk hedging. I hate that. But the option overlay of the risk management is what I like. And we talked about it because it's like, it's not just making money when the world's gone to crap, but it's also making money when everything is this.
But the the challenge is living within the public pension constraints. Because the right answer is wherever the best risk reward is where we should gravitate towards, if it's not, whether it's called defensive or option overlay.
No, I know that. But it's what I'm saying is that for that education, it's actually all encompassing. There's some strategies that are like both. So calling it one is not necessarily, at the end of the day, there's some managers out there that are really interesting that actually are like in this bucket. That's kind of very different than what you're actually calling them, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot of different
structures,
types of managers in that RMS bucket. And we got to think, what is the objective? What are they adding to that asset class? Or in the case of kind of the tail risk, defensive, at the total portfolio.
What are the managers you have are optimistic? They are optimistic. They're volatility optimistic, which is like this weird, you know what I mean? It's not really defensive. And it's actually opportunistic on an option overlay way. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm just saying. I'm saying it's just that I, on the education basis, that you kind of have to be a little bit free thinking, I think.
Yeah, and to do your point, I think what we want to do there is get a bit more specific. When we talked about it last time, it was very broad and
yes.
First responder, second responder, third responder. What are some actual strategies and what's it rated? All right, that's good feedback. We'll come back. We definitely have that relative to peer group. We did that analysis in January. BlackRock does an annual study, and they narrowed it down to kind of 15 plans that are close peers to us and where they're allocated. So we're refreshing that. We have a call with them Monday, so we'll bring that back, both to the ISC and the board.
And if they have that study, could we see that as well?
Yeah. Moving on to a recommendation in the public equity portfolio, we are recommending to invest $121 million into Aerostreet's global long only and their 130-30 extension strategy. This would be funded through the termination of the Manulife investment management account. Why Aerostreet? We'll get a bit more into the search and the process, but they've had very strong outperformance and very consistent performance across many different market cycles and market environments. They have a deep and stable team, very low turnover at the partner level in the organization, differentiated process, They're a quantitative investment firm, so differentiated. We think they're differentiated in that space, and it's different than anything else we have in the portfolio right now. All of our equity portfolios are pretty concentrated, traditional stock picking portfolios with a little bit of a tilt. I think we're getting a lot closer to true core exposure with Arrow Street. So when we think about potential changes down the road, they feel they could kind of sit right in the middle if we need to make a change on other managers in the portfolio. And then they're less correlated to some of the other strategies given what they do and how they go about doing it. Worth a minute spending on kind of their process and then what is the extension strategy? What do they do differently there? But they have a big research team. They're quantitative. They have a quantitative process. So their research team studies all these economic signals, and that goes into a model, which, you know, they rank every stock in the universe based on their quantitative model. And then their portfolio construction team builds a portfolio based on certain constraints relative to the benchmark. And that's what they do in the long only. In the extension, you know, if you think about outside of the mega concentrated stocks, a lot of the stocks in the ACWI index are 5 bips, 1 bip, 2 bip. All they can do in the long only is not own those stocks. So what they do in the extension is the stocks, they have the least favorable ratings on, they're allowed to short those stocks up to 30% of the total exposure. And then they can go long up to 130% of the total exposure. And then the FBM piece of it, their model picks a lot of stocks that are lower beta than the market. So they use a futures overlay to bring that beta back up to one. So it tracks, you know, beta one to the ACWI. And then given the extension piece is an alternative because they use leverage and short, that's the piece of it we need 8 votes for approval on. A few other points before I hand over to Luis to talk about the process. The capacity, they've managed capacity, I guess, as closely as they can for a $290 million firm, but they have closed the global strategies. We don't expect any future capacity to come available in the long only. We'd expect any they might reopen, they expect to reopen the extension potentially next year. So any ability to add to our allocation with Arrow Street would likely come through the extension product. And then just want to give Makita credit for flagging Arrow Street as a top pick early on as we were launching this process. We kind of got in the pipeline early, and they held $130 million of capacity for us knowing the search was upcoming. That I'll hand it over to Luis to talk through the process.
Thank you, Ryan, and good morning, everyone. I'll quickly talk about the search process that we did for the Global Public Equity Search. So we started off by having an initial conversation with Makita, asking them to provide us a list of names that they thought highly of. Arrow Street was one of them. After that, we proceeded to screen both the Global Core and Global Value universe in investment. That was around 1,200 products. We then did some screening and qualitative screening as well. And we were able to narrow it down to 35 names, in which we had a follow-up conversation with Makita to get some thoughts and comments on the names that were screened through and that we were considering. After that conversation, we were able to narrow it down to 10 names, which we had an initial conversation with. After that, those conversations, we decided to issue 7 RFP to 7 different firms. After reviewing the RFP, staff decided to have 4 semi-finalists. I'll highlight those here in a bit. And after having conversations with portfolio managers for all four semi-finalists, we had strong conviction on Arrow Street and decided to bring Arrow Street only for the IAC to interview, compared to typically having to come in and have the IAC interview them. As mentioned, these are the 7 firms that we issued an RFP to, and obviously the 4 semifinalists are bolded here. This is just a high level overview of the semifinalists. As you can see, we had 2 quantitative strategies and 2 fundamental strategies, all rated by Makita, or they were aware of them, except for Orbis, as they were not rated, but Makita knew of them during the process. Now, looking at the scoring, as you can see, staff had high conviction on Arrow Street across the board. I do want to say that it was a forced ranking, four being high conviction and one being, we thought other strategies were better in some areas. Or you see Orbis being last here, but we think they're obviously one of the four best strategies in the universe. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we had conversations with all the PMs across all different strategies. And after those conversations, we decided that Arrow Street was the best fit for our search. Now I'll bring it back to Ryan to kind of highlight more Arrow Street.
Okay, thanks, Luis. And it's Luis's first time leading the search, so he did a great job. So I just want to thank him. So this is just showing the style map. As I said, the Arrow Street exposure is pretty close to a kind of true core exposure. The extension, which is in the yellow, has kind of expressed more of a value tilt over time. But our other current managers, Boston Partners, kind of deeper value in the red. The cross over there is WCM, and then Walter Scott's the diamond in the middle. So good fit with our current managers in the portfolio. In terms of outperformance and alpha expectations in these two strategies, the long only has a target of 2.2% net alpha, net of fees, compared to the equity IMI. And then the extension has a target of 4.5% net, with a little bit higher tracking error, but still, 5 to 9%. So tracking error is consistent with a lot of our active managers in the portfolio. And they've exceeded those return targets over kind of all, most of these longer term trailing time periods. If we look at the long only, they long term 10 year outperformed by 3% compared to the ACWI, and then the extension 18% return over the 10 year period compared to 11% for the benchmark. So 7% outperformance on the extension, both kind of top decile performers in the peer group. When we talk about the return consistency, Antipodes was one of the four finalists. They're a very strong fundamental manager. This chart's looking at kind of plots of rolling 3-year returns over a 10-year period compared to the benchmark. So anything above the line, that's a 3-year period they've outperformed. Anything below the line is a 3-year period they've underperformed. And like I said, this is a good manager that you can see kind of has periods of outperformance, periods of underperformance. When we look to Arrow Street, this is the long only. They've outperformed in every 3-year period over this 10-year time period, and then a bit more clustered. And you kind of, you can see the higher alpha and similar levels of consistency in the extension product.
This chart still cracks me up.
Yeah.
It still does.
We call it beautiful. Made offline at IAC.
But you can only say that at the IAC.
I know. You only can say that at the IAC.
9% every year.
Yes.
So they've had a very good run. But we think kind of the way they go about building the model and the way they are very protective of what goes in that model and the way they adjust that model over time should continue to produce alpha, maybe not at this level, but we feel confident in their process and what they're bringing to the table. Any questions?
Yeah, just one quick one. Obviously, screening and going through everything you went through to get to this point, there's a lot of other factors that you look at because you're trying to predict what might happen. The only thing we care about, obviously, from the day we write the check going forward is the absolute net return that they produce. Because there's so many names that went into the top of that funnel and so many people that got cut out for different qualitative reasons along the way, have you gone back and taken Arrow Street to see if anybody in that funnel that started off that 1,100 whatever firms, if anybody compares performance-wise to them and see if there was some reason you might have kicked them out of the funnel too soon?
Yeah.
Whatever purpose that or whatever reason that might have been. And just go back and challenge logic just to make sure that somebody else wouldn't have made it except for this one particular item that you used to kick them out.
Yeah. We have another, like we go to EVS and we have a number of different filters based on, kind of size, not just performance. And we try to keep a pretty wide bandwidth. Like in order to kick someone out of the search, they have to have underperformed multiple time periods by like more than 1%. So we try to keep the knowing that past returns aren't that, and you know, aren't going to predict future returns. We try not to remove candidates based on kind of return profiles, more based on, you know, the style, AUM, track length of track record. There's probably a few that are up there. We'd have to look at kind of why they, you know, what's driving their performance compared to what's driving Arrow Street's performance. But I mean, if you look at just kind of pure ranking, the on the 10-year, they're second percentile or 98th percentile on the long only, and 99th on the extension.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, is there anybody that would have fallen into any of those categories that got kicked out of maybe that first screen where you went from 1100 down to 98, just to see if there's a flaw in the logic somewhere in between?
Mm-hmm.
Essentially back testing the process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just to see if something falls out, that, and then you can say, okay, well, somewhere in there we did something that might have.
Yeah.
And I mean, challenging your logic that of how, or challenging Makita's logic as to how they constructed the entire pyramid.
Yeah. And like pyramid, we construct that. We get a list of names from Makita. We try to bring some additional names to the table through our manager research. I would say we do more of kind of what you're talking about when we get kind of to the narrower part of the funnel, where we look at, you know, how do we go from 97 down to 48, and why are we removing people, and is it the right screen, and is it kind of producing false positives or false negatives on removal? And then just the other thing we added to the process this time is we ran all these charts, like this investment book. We picked four different time periods to see how would this look different if we ran this at the end of 2020, if we ran the same search at, you know, mid 2022, kind of different market environments. And I mean, it, to Arrow Street's consistency, they were near the top on each one of those.
And again, I've got no problem with Arrow Street. Just curious about that.
Yeah.
Process.
A, you know, rifle shot back through the process just to see if it all holds water.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the beauties, the integrity of the process, as well as the, you know, the team that they have working on this process and the longevity and experience that they bring to it.
About Arrow Street? I mean, from the IACA's point of view, IAT rather, we see a lot of like managers, right? They jumped out because they're, as they got bigger, they got better. Their performance improved. And as we see with big funds, it's the opposite. And they actually are honing their process. That was the first thing. They're jumping by their alpha that they're bringing above index and peers is significant. It's, that's why we kind of, you know, correlated to things that we don't want to say right now. But they are also thoughtful about the way they approach capacity. When they stop their capacity, they stop it and they say they don't turn it back on unless they do this massive research about what they can do, what they're looking at. I mean, it's a very thoughtful process, and the number, and quantitatively, qualitatively, this team or the manager that came out, he jumped out to me like the WCM manager did, or like the BlackRock secondary. They were impressive. They were just impressive on a quantitative and qualitative aspect. And I think the IAC all agreed on that one too. That's just my two cents.
Any other questions from the board on Arrow Street?
Oh, one last comment too, which I also have never seen in a long time, is that they actually make money on their shorts. They broke it down for us. So not only are they generating alpha on the long, they're generating alpha on the short. And I don't see a lot of managers doing that at all, beyond just like capturing the beta and just walking away. They are doing some good things.
Industry research.
Yeah. Some industry research. Yeah.
Hey, Ryan, this is Rob. I have one question. And we've touched on this in the past. What do we do to compare our equity returns using managers as opposed to index funds, whether domestic, international? I mean, do we do any empirical assessments to say, if we had done the exact, precisely the same asset allocation within our equities in index funds, how would we have fared? You know, I come at this with less sophistication than many of you all, but I also come at it with a bias that it's so darn difficult to be in indices year after year over time. And what do we do to pressure test that to make sure that we're on the right path in actually employing managers, particularly on an after cost basis?
Yeah, so I mean, 40% of our equity portfolio is in passive right now. When we've talked about it, you know, kind of over the past few months on, you know, it's been hard in this environment with, you know, a huge up market and kind of narrow market leadership for traditional active managers to keep up. And you've seen that in our kind of 3 and 5 year returns. So to be fair, we would have been better off in passive equities, just looking at return streams over the last 3 to 5 years. We expect that, you know, all markets kind of ebb and flow. We expect that to reverse at some point, especially in a down market where some of our managers should be more protective. What kind of stands out about Arrow Street is I feel like with the active portfolio, a lot of times we're putting together 4 different active managers plus small cap plus EM to eke out 50 bips of outperformance. And then, you know, we talk about how much time, attention, effort from the team goes into building that portfolio. Is that better spent somewhere else? And I think that's the right assessment to take. But we do feel that there's probably some other strategies more similar to this that can produce a more meaningful alpha in that portfolio. That's
the only the only thing I'd take issue with is I'm not sure there is an ebb and flow passive to active over time. I mean, they collectively ebb and flow, but there always seems to be a sort of perpetual delta or differential. And I understand the bias that we have to be more active. That's what we do. But I would hope the IAC would look at this and say, you know, maybe we ought to be ooching up our passive component here.
Fair. And I mean, we have tweaked the weight of passive in our equity portfolio over time. It started at 25%, it's at 40 now. I think as we add active managers, they really need to be bringing something new, different, or, you know, consistent alpha to the table. So I think that's, you know, that's the trade-off and what we should consider when we talk about how to construct the public equity portfolio and what tweaks we might want to make down the road.
Also, I think the logic makes total sense, but it's hard to disconnect like innate biases. And one of which for me is we've basically had an up and to the right sloping chart in public markets for the last 16 years, right? And so going totally passive, and I know Rob's not saying that, but moments in time and starting price is so important for assets, right? And so it's a dilemma.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of similar to the Walter Scott conversation where you know, the market turned or it's a different environment and our portfolio is still not outperforming, then the harder questions come then.
Also, just to add, internally, we have looked into this as well, you know, in continuation to the conversation we had last time, at the board level or at the IC level, wherein the active passive conversation came again. So in terms of the valuations, we are working internally to put that together. The dispersion in valuations, as I mentioned during the portfolio update earlier, like the market leadership has been very concentrated across all the indices that we are seeing, be it MSCI ACWI, S&P 500, or even the emerging markets. And it's a matter of time when that rotation happens from these selective names to a broader market. And the selective names who have really driven the passive index over the last few years, they underperform the broader market. So active management or active managers help in that kind of scenario. And to Ryan's point, reiterating again, you know, if Walter Scott, for example, doesn't do better in that kind of scenario, we really need to, you know, rethink our approach and our philosophy then.
All right, any other questions, comments on Arrow Street and the recommendation there?
Thank you.
Okay, awesome. Can you guys pull up the motion? All right, so the recommendation is to authorize the executive director to terminate the Manulife Global equity allocation and enter into an investment management agreement with Arrow Street to invest up to a 6% allocation to be allocated between the long only and extension strategy.
So moved.
Second.
All right. Motion is second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I forgot to say one thing on. it doesn't affect the vote.
I know. I was just counting.
Okay. So on the fee structure, we just want to make you aware on the long only, there's a base fee structure and a performance fee. We prefer the performance fee structure. And we have that structure in place in a lot of our active managers in the portfolio, a similar structure. So as long as kind of the legal mechanics work the way they described it to us, where it's a 25% base fee, 25% performance share based on a high water mark of our performance, they need to be outperforming for DPFP since inception to pay the performance fee. That's the structure we enter into on the long only. The extension is only a performance fee structure, and then the base fee option is 80 bips. So that's kind of the trade-off between the base fee and the performance fee.
We had all in favor, but said aye. Any opposed? Signify by saying nay. Hearing none, the motion passes.
Hey, Ryan, you know what we may want to do is have Makita come in, and I know they've probably done it for somebody else, or they can even send it to us, but what's their evaluation of a passive-only portfolio, a hybrid, and why it makes sense and when it makes sense? I'm positive they've done that before, yeah. And they probably just pulled something off the shelf.
Lee, are you on?
Yes, Brian, and I heard the request, and certainly we can, you know, discuss and prepare and come back to a future meeting this year and address that.
And I always like to ask Leah, what did Makita run some discretionary portfolio? So what do you guys do in the money that you're completely managing yourselves and making decisions on? I think they have a similar global approach and a decent amount in passive in those portfolios as well, correct, Leah?
In the equity piece, it has fluctuated passive roughly somewhere between 40 and 50%. And then it has been active in other balance, a little bit over half on average for the past several years. In most other areas, if you think fixed income, you know, it's mostly actively managed. So when you aggregate across the total portfolio, you may get to about a 50% in total passively managed. You get broad exposure at low fees, and then you try to generate excess returns in the balance.
Okay. No, I think since it's come up often, I think maybe kind of adding that into the asset allocation could be a good exercise as we think about.
Well, and Ryan, I think you should keep it on the back burner. So every 3 years, you can bring the same presentation out and show it to the new trustees and go, in advance of you asking the question, here is, you know, something you should read so we don't have to take up board time with it.
Okay.
Because it's a good question. And I think it's going to come up over and over again. As a prudent fiduciary, ask the question, you know, why actively manage when there are all these ETFs and indexes?
Yeah, fair. All right.
One question.
Yeah.
What are the logistics with Manulife? Do you have to submit a redemption? Is it quarterly or is it going to be?
No, it's a separate account. So we custody all the assets.
At the May? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a very liquid portfolio.
Okay, perfect.
So we just need to think through kind of timing of when we go into Arrow Street. You can only do it bi-monthly on the extension, daily on the long only. So we'll have Manulife liquidate their account and fund into Arrow Street.
But it doesn't have to go dollar for dollar. You can just go into the new and then start to
and we try to maintain equity exposure through the trade to make sure we're not pulling 5% out of the market for a couple of days.
Actually, it's a police and fire pension fund. We roll up in there with some tactical officers and we show up and we ask for our money.
Yeah,
but just for the exposure, why wouldn't you just like absolutely just, you know, sell it out and do the index until you get into the other side? I mean.
Yeah, it's going to be a month, so we're comfortable kind of maintaining where it's at. We've kind of known this is coming throughout the search. All right, appreciate it.
Hey,
Thank you, Lisa.
Ryan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good.
So the next two items, typically we'd go in a closed session for, but I'll see if we need to do that. So first of all, there's no item for legal. I don't know how many
Yay.
meetings in a row that has
Three, I
been.
think.
Yeah. On the disabilities, the first disability application 2026-2D, that member has requested to withdraw that application. So I'm not presenting that one today. The other one, 2026-3D, that one, the case is very clear. We can go to closed session if you want to talk about it more. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it, but as a police officer, that very clear they cannot do their job. So did you want to go in closed session, talk about that one more, or are you okay to? My recommendation would be to approve the disability for 2026-3D with no recalls.
I don't need to go.
I fully support that.
What you read?
Okay.
I'll see that if you approve it, then it goes through. And if you don't, you want us to know.
That's the hardship.
Oh, that's a hardship.
Yeah. Disabilities, I can't approve or deny.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Okay. So if you're all good with that, we wouldn't need to go into closed session. I would just need a motion on the second.
A motion to approve the disability retirement applications 2026-3D with no future recalls.
I'll move.
Second. Motion and second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Hearing none, the motion passes.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. The last item here is the executive director's report. Your MCPRS monitor is included for you. We're in the process of completing an open records request that we received this days ago. As far as the chief financial officer recruitment goes, we have made an offer contingent on a background check to an individual. That person has accepted the offer, so we're just waiting on the background check. So hopefully next month you will see a new face sitting here. So that is, I'm very pleased about that process, and our executive search firm we used was excellent during the process. Employee service awards, we have a senior retirement counselor, Cynthia Thomas. She's critical to the operations of the benefits group, and
hey Kelly, Kelly, I'm sorry, Kelly, quick interruption. Who did we use as a search firm?
EPHRS. They do a lot of governmental searches, and I was really looking for, it's really hard to find a CFO that knows pension stuff, but the accounting is very similar, governmental accounting, so that's the direction I was targeting, especially
yeah,
because with our TMRS retirement makes us attractive.
Yeah, makes sense. Very good. Thank you.
Okay, so with that, I just wanted to announce that Cynthia's hitting her 15 years. I appreciate all her time and compassion with the members over that time. So I don't have anything else.
Okay. Can I get a motion to adjourn the regular meeting?
I'm on.
Second.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and second. All in favor during the regular meeting, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. The opposed say nay.
I mean, sorry. No.
Sorry. Mr. Contrarian, hearing you.
No, I'm sorry.
The ayes outweigh the nays. The motion passes. We move on to the supplemental meeting. Supplemental meeting is reconvened. Is there any public comment? Please raise your hand online. Nobody online? Okay. Moving on to approve the minutes for the supplemental meeting of June 11th. I got a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll move.
A second?
Second.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Hearing none, the ayes have it. I get a motion to adjourn the supplemental meeting.
So moved.
Get a second.
Second.
All right. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. We are